This acid-base unit is really meant to go along with the renal unit, the kidney pathology unit that we teach, but it's valuable to think about also the respiratory component involved in acid-base management. Before we really get going with the slideshow and the kind of the lecture tutorial part of this, you need to be sure that you printed out the handout. Now, there are a couple of things you could print out from the web. One is the slides, and that's actually a small PDF file of the slideshow that we're going to be using. But the handout is just that. It is the handout. It's about 10 pages long. We're going to skip along through it because much of that is review. But it is a handout like you would be used to seeing in lecture. So be sure you have that. Print that out. And if need be, stop this to get that and have that in hand as we go along through it. Now, when we think about acid-base balance, obviously what we're looking at is the electrical neutrality that exists in our system. Cations and anions equal each other. We don't always measure all of those, and so sometimes it does look like things may be out of whack a bit. Also, when we think about problems of this, of electrolyte balance, and particularly hydrogens, meaning acid-base balance, pH changes, we want to keep in mind that sometimes these are difficult to diagnose because more than one condition that leads to an acid-base imbalance may be present in the patient at the same time. And the other thing is that you want to be anticipating this. And that is to say that for some conditions, you can put your money down that there's going to be an acid-base problem. For example, somebody with emphysema, they develop a pneumonia. You know there's going to be a problem blowing off carbon dioxide. There's going to be an acid-base imbalance. Somebody that has been vomiting for a long time, you know there's there's going to be an acid-base imbalance because they've been throwing up and getting rid of the hydrochloric acid and so on. Others that are very common, of course, would be ketoacidosis and so forth. But less common would be things such as problems of poor perfusion, tissue perfusion following myocardial infarction. And someone doesn't have to be overtly in cardiogenic shock to be developing lactic acid. Even dehydration will lead to diminished tissue perfusion, not absent tissue perfusion, but diminished. And that can lead to problems of acid-base balance because of lactic acid development. So the point is, it's not just a diagnostic exercise. Hey, can I make this diagnosis? It's being prepared and anticipating this and keeping it from getting out of balance, really far out of balance. Because pH changes and electrolyte changes can mean fatal cardiac arrhythmias and the like. And so you need to be ready for that. And that's kind of the reason it's important to understand it and the reason we're going to be spending a little bit of time with this. So, as the handout says, and as I've implied, the hydrogens, the proton, is a really special case here in terms of what's going to happen. And the way our body handles that is, of course, that we shuffle this back and forth between carbon dioxide and carbonic acid, combining that with water, of course, carbon dioxide combined with water, to suck up these hydrogens, or to help us blow them off, effectively blow off the carbon dioxide in the lungs and help keep some kind of electrical neutrality here. this slide shows just a few of the things that the body has to deal with in terms of maintaining electrical neutrality. Obviously, there are things which we call non-volatile acids, such as phosphoric acid, and carbonic acid, which is itself non-volatile, but of course it's shuttled back and forth to carbon dioxide through carbonic anhydrase. So we think about volatile acids, such as carbon dioxide. Well, you might say, hey, where's the nitrogen or the hydrogen in this thing? I don't see that being an acid, but of course it's linked to bicarbonate through the carbonic anhydrase enzyme. The Henderson-Hasselbalch equation here describes how we calculate that pH based on the how we can calculate it at any rate based on carbon dioxide and dissolved, on the basis of carbonic the carbonate ion and the dissolved CO2 in the blood. there's not a lot of CO2 in the blood. Most of that, of course, gets shuttled right off to carbonic anhydrase into carbonic acid and exists as bicarbonate ion. But these cats must have been pretty smart to have thought that thing up. I mean, it's all I can do to keep my phone number in my head. So we're going to be focusing largely on carbon dioxide and carbonic acid initially, but when we start talking about renal problems, we'll be looking at non-volatile acids such as the phosphoric acid here. This is the enzyme of such renown, carbonic anhydrase, that shuttles carbon dioxide back and forth to carbonic acid, and of course that dissociates into carbonic bicarbonate ion. This is clearly very important. If you lack that enzyme, and some people do, it's incompatible with life. I should say some conceptions do, but that's incompatible with life. So this is the relationship that exists here, and it's shuttling it back and forth all the time to help maintain our pH where it needs to be. Then we can blow off the carbon dioxide, effectively getting rid of some of that acid, because we've locked it up now as water. How do we go about actually measuring this? Well, the measurement requires really arterial blood to be certain of the pH and the dissolved carbon dioxide, that is to say the free gas that would be in the blood. We want this arterial because it's been through the lungs. It's been sort of optimally adjusted, let's say, for the pH at that point. I mean, you can do a venous pH, but it's really not going to be very helpful. The pH is maintained in a fairly tight range, typically around 7.4. 7.42 is probably the most common number we would see. But there's kind of a range in there based on level of activity and respiration and so forth, and whether you're sleeping or not. We don't have a whole lot of control over the PCO2, the dissolved CO2, and by extension then the bicarbonate ion. We can blow it off. We have the control exists in terms of getting rid of it. It doesn't really exist in terms of generating it. I realize you can say, hey, I could generate a lot of CO2 if I wanted to. I'd go out and run up and down the street here, and yeah, that would do it. But for the most part, our control is CNS-related, and that has to do with respiratory control. When the dissolved carbon dioxide gets too high, you cannot help it. You will start breathing like a little steam engine, blowing off the CO2, at least in the acute phase. If you've got emphysema and so on, and you become adapted to these higher levels of CO2, yeah, that's different, of course. What is kind of contribution do we have in the way of the kidneys? Well, there are two very important things here with respect to the kidney, and I want to be sure we understand what those are. And that is one step in the kidney control of pH of the body is the reabsorption of the bicarbonate. Bicarbonate is cleared in the urine. We'll talk about that. And you got to get it back. If you can't get it back, you're in a world of hurt. So that's one thing. That's preventive. That isn't quite so much control of our system pH. It's preventing it from getting it out of whack. The kidney, on the other hand, can actually secrete acid. There are two titratable acids that are secreted. We'll look at those in just a minute here. So there's two steps. One is reabsorption. The other is generation of titratable acids. And that goes on in two different places in the kidney. All right, so this slide shows what we were just talking about, and that is that the dissolved CO2, which typically is around 40 millimeters mercury in a healthy person, is controlled fundamentally by blowing it off, not really by generating it. So, and the renal control gets to be very important when it comes to sort of the fine-tuning, but also the recovery of the cleared bicarbonate. Now, this is what this is showing here. This is the first step. The first thing is that whether we like it or not, a lot of small things are cleared in the urine. That's just the way the kidneys function. When urine is produced, glucose is cleared, amino acids are cleared, variety of things just go right out in that ultrafiltrate in the glomerulus. And they've got to be picked back up. If you don't recover them, there's going to be a big problem. And that's particularly the case with bicarbonate. Bicarbonate's a small molecule. It just passes right on through that basement membrane, and there it is in the urine. And you're about to pee out your principal buffer. You can't let that happen. So there has to be some way of recovering the bicarbonate. So that's the first thing the kidney's involved with, is effectively a recovery step. And it is getting it back. And that goes on here in the proximal tubular epithelial cell. And if we look on the luminal side of that diagram, we see that the bicarbonate, which was cleared, is flowing along. And what the proximal tubular epithelial cell does is it has an ion pump in the wall and the cell membrane that pumps hydrogens out and recollects sodium. And the hydrogens combine, reform with the bicarbonate that's in the urine before it can get too far. It combines it with the bicarbonate ion, the hydrogen, the proton does, and that gives us, brings it back to the carbonic acid, and then carbonic anhydrase splits it into CO2 and water. The CO2 and water passively come back across the membrane, and now they're inside the cell. And another carbonic anhydrase now causes them to join again. And now you got, now the carbonic acid has magically reappeared within the cell cytoplasm, within the cytosol. It disassociates into a hydrogen and bicarbonate ion. The carbonate ion is shuttled out into the bloodstream, and the hydrogen ion goes back into the urine, into that new urine, to recollect another carbonic acid. So it's kind of a little bit of magic, a little, sleight of hand, effectively, because the carbonic acid is recollected as carbon dioxide into the cell. If we don't do that, our principal buffering agent is going to fly right out in the urine, and we're never be able to maintain body pH. And in fact, people who are born are fetuses and conceptions that we have which lack carbonic anhydrase. This is the thing. They cannot do this. They cannot recover that, and it's incompatible with life. So the first step that the kidney's involved with is really a recovery step, and it's getting the carbonic acid back into the system and then splitting it back as carbonate, putting the carbonate back into the bloodstream. Now, that goes out in the proximal convoluted tubule. In the distal tubule, there are two things that are going on where we actually produce titratable acid. One is phosphoric acid. The other is the ammonia ion. Now, let's take a look at that. And these are things in which we are, in fact, getting rid of acid. Now, for this, there is no real exchange here. There's no carbonate involvement other than the fact that we are splitting carbonic acid in the tubular epithelial cell to give us a hydrogen, to give us a proton, and that proton goes out into the lumen of the urine while the bicarbonate and the mechanism for shifting it out there is either with the phosphoric acid or to combine with ammonia, as shown here in this one. The bicarbonate ion then goes unaccompanied, it's not accompanied by a hydrogen then, goes back into the bloodstream. And so that really is one of the things that allows us to do fine regulation of the pH of the blood by getting rid of hydrogen ions into the urine, giving rise to phosphoric acid and the ammonia ion. And that's very important. And as you can imagine, if there's problem with tubular epithelial cell health because of poor perfusion, poor oxygenation, and so forth in the kidney parenchyma, or because of some toxin that's present that kills the tubular epithelial cells, we're going to lose this capacity to be able to secrete these free hydrogens, these free protons. So that's what's working for us. And again, carbonic anhydrase, as you can see, plays a pivotal role in all of that. And just to restate here, what is going on in that proximal convoluted tubule is a recovery effort. It's not a matter that this is some active thing that somehow controls hydrogen levels. It's basically a method of getting that bicarbonate back, which has been cleared in the urine. It just comes out all on its own because it's so doggone small. And put it in perspective, look how much we clear in the course of a 24-hour period here. 4,000 millimoles of bicarbonate. Well, in the period of a few hours, you would lose so much bicarbonate that your pH would get way out of whack and you'd die is what it amounts to. So carbonic anhydrase plays a heck of a role both in the brush border of those epithelial cells as well as within the cytosol of it. If we're following along here on the handout, then we're on page 3 taking a look at all the fancy stuff that's going on. Let's go ahead now and consider situations where things aren't right. And because of some disease process, we do develop either a metabolic or respiratory acidosis or alkalosis. Now, this nomogram, which we have on this slide, then shows a variety of things that can happen. It's kind of a complicated one. We have to sort of look all around it because there's different legends on this. The bottom shows the arterial pH. Up the y-axis, we have the bicarbonate level. And then across the top of it, it actually shows the hydrogen ion level itself. And you can see that based on certain conditions, whether it's acute or chronic, there may be bigger changes or some adaptive changes that have gone on, but you can see where things will shift. And as the pH drops, obviously you'd expect the hydrogen ion concentration to be accumulating, and it might well be that the bicarbonate's going to go down because there may be some compensatory mechanism going at work, say like the respiratory blowing off the carbon dioxide. This works well when there's one cause, one problem, and not multiple things coming together. And life is fairly complicated for some patients, and so it's very possible at times we will see different kinds of issues coming at the same time. So, and always there's some level of compensation, whether it's renal or whether it's respiratory. And as I say, we can have either alkalosis or acidosis. So this big green flower-looking kind of thing is a little intimidating, but if we think about and anticipate what might be going on with the patients, depending on what they've got, we ought to know just about where they're going to land on this and be prepared to head off problems. Yeah, well, life isn't always that simple in terms of just having a single issue. It would be nice if we could just sort of kick back and snooze here in this hammock, but life's not quite that relaxed here. So people are entitled to more than one condition, more than one disease, and many of those are going to have acid-base imbalance as an element of that. So how are we going to determine that? Well, you're probably aware of such things as the anion gap and the bicarbonate gap and other things we're going to talk about here. We're going to try and put that in perspective. We'd also look at another negative ion, keep an eye on that, and that's chloride concentration in the bloodstream. Again, a fairly large ion would be a quantity of ion at any rate. So let's take a look, move ahead here. How are we going to figure things out? Well, as I've indicated so far, one, of course, is to be prepared for this, to be on the lookout. And that is to say you can anticipate these things because there are certain diseases, certain conditions that are going to lead to problems. Be ready. Don't be caught off guard here. How do we go about diagnosing it? Well, obviously, there has to be that suspicion. You have to be thinking about it, looking ahead. History and physical, very important. Obviously, we already talked about the blood work, the arterial blood gases and serum electrolytes. And sometimes people will actually compare venous and arterial samples of bicarbonate and so forth. What we're going to be doing here is looking at two calculations that lead us to a third calculation, I guess three in total, the anion gap and the bicarbonate gap that will help us determine. Are we looking at a single problem that's causing the acid-base imbalance or something that has, that there are multiple conditions? Because things can shift around and even have a normal pH if you have a metabolic alkalosis and a respiratory acidosis. Still, you have two metabolic problems to deal with. So what are the sorts of things that we would think about? Let's again look back here at what might be causing changes in the anion gap. And we will come and look at how we calculate that in just a minute, but my guess is you're probably fairly familiar with this already from physiology. What causes a high anion gap? Well, things that add these additional anions that we don't typically measure. All of us have an anion gap. We all have some little bits of anions that are circulating there that we don't really measure unless the lab's asked to do so. And that's what this slide is showing us, ketoacidosis and lactic acidosis. That's kind of a giveaway. Causes of non-ion gap acidosis. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Bicarbonate loss from the GI tract, say in the case of diarrhea. One of the things that we want to do then, we're going to come around to looking at what is the anion gap, how does that differ from the expected anion gap, and what is the difference in the bicarbonate. And those two should go hand in hand. And we'll see that in just a minute. We always want to keep in mind the other anions we can measure routinely, like chloride and so forth. And the history is more complex than you might think. Medication history would be very important. For example, diuretics can clearly change things, loop-type diuretics and so on, carbonic anhydrase inhibitors clearly. But sleeping medications, if you have somebody who has already some coexisting pulmonary disease and you basically put them too much to sleep, they're going to clearly have a high PCO2. Let's look at this slide, which deals with calculating the anion gap. And again, all of us have an anion gap. It's typically about 12. And where does it come from? How do we figure this? Well, we take the sodium, and that's the only thing we really take, the sodium, and add to that the other anions, the anions that were going on, such as chloride and carbonate, and subtract those two from the sodium. And that's pretty much by convention what we do. So there's a difference. We'll find that we've got a few more sodiums than we have negative charge to counterbalance that. Well, of course, there are other anions that we haven't measured. There's always a little bit of lactate in all of us. A variety of things that will be in the circulating blood, serum proteins that carry a negative charge and so forth. So there are these things that exist there. And those we normally don't measure. So all of us have, in the healthy state of affairs, around a 12 millimole anion gap. It's when this thing starts to disappear or get larger that we get suspicious. Most often that we will see medical problems with respect to certainly metabolic conditions would be an increase in lactate and so forth that would lead to an increased anion gap. Other things that I've listed here, rarely reductions in calcium, magnesium, and potassium and so forth. What about a decreased gap? This is kind of an interesting thing, where the gap gets smaller or disappears or becomes negative, in fact. Well, there may be cations that we don't know about. And again, medication history would be vitally important here. For example, lithium. Lithium will offset. This isn't something we routinely measured. Lithium is used as a medication for bipolar disease in some cases. And it's a cation that's in there, and there will be a compensatory change in the anion gap to accommodate for that. And unless you know that, you won't be able to explain it. So there are a variety of things, and I honestly don't know how all of these operate. Reduction in serum proteins, again, I assume that something must increase in size to accommodate for that. So there are a variety of things that will change that. The simple rules that we look at, again, this applies to a single cause underlying disease. If it's metabolic or respiratory, what do we have? Well, respiratory acidosis, you would expect to have a high PCO2. Somebody who can't breathe for a variety of reasons, have trouble breathing. Metabolic acidosis, the bicarbonate is what we'd be following here. An example of that, of course, would be lactic acid buildup and acetone in the case of acetoacetic acid and so forth in diabetic ketoacidosis. Respiratory alkalosis, there isn't a whole lot you can look at here. Often the PCO2 is much lower if someone is really huffing and puffing, they're nervous or something, they're breathing hard, blowing off a lot of carbon dioxide. It can be quite low. As you'd expect with metabolic alkalosis, the bicarbonate would be elevated. So you can sort of throw it into a quick category like this if it's a single cause. So you can sort of summarize that. Bicarbonate, underlying cause is most likely metabolic. CO2 changes, most likely the problem is respiratory in nature. Yeah, well, that would be fine. Let's just take a look here at some of the things that lead to these. Metabolic acidosis. With an anion gap. Again, we just alluded to that. Increased production, endogenous production of acids like keto acids and lactate and so forth. Accumulation of endogenous acids that you can't get rid of because of kidney disease. Metabolic acidosis with no anion gap or no ion gap at all. In this case, again, you have to suspect what's going on because it may not be terribly evident and you have to know from the history. Loss of bicarbonates, as in the case of severe diarrhea. This would be a case with children in particular who don't have a big reserve, fluid or electrolyte reserve. Renal loss of bicarbonate, and we're going to talk about that towards the end of this. And obviously things that change carbonic anhydrase action, and those are medications and so forth. Metabolic alkalosis, vomiting. Potassium wasting conditions such as Kahn's syndrome. Remember, Kahn's is an overproduction of aldosterone. So there are a variety of other things that can lead to these. But in this case, again, we're looking at fundamentally single event or single cause. respiratory is probably the most common thing that we'll encounter here. And I mentioned before CNS, particularly problems with central nervous system, person who's obtunded. Not breathing well, airway obstruction, people with neuromuscular disease where they just don't have the strength to do it, emphysema, things like that. Respiratory alkalosis, a little different. Some of these I honestly don't understand quite what the connection is here, but the CO2 is low. A person can get very anxious and start huffing and puffing and blow off carbon dioxide, and they can have a variety of symptoms that will make them really think that they're sick. Including chest pain, they feel short of breath even though they're breathing like a little steam engine. So a number of things can lead to respiratory alkalosis where someone's just simply blowing it up. You can do it to yourself, make yourself dizzy. People get tingling of the extremities, tingling around the mouth, even some palpitations and so forth. So instead of acidotic, of course, they're alkalotic, and the pH will show that, and their PCO2 will be low. But these are some other conditions that are associated with that. Well, what we've been talking about to this point then were things that had a single cause. Life is not always that simple, particularly with elderly patients who may have multiple conditions going on that might change the acid-base balance. And in order to determine that, we do kind of a mathematic manipulation of the anion gap, at least what we expect it to be in and what we measure it or calculate it as, and the same for the bicarbonate. And by comparing those two, we can tell whether or not there are two things at work. It goes like this. We know that everybody's going to have an anion gap in a healthy condition of around 12. And so what we do is we assume that that's what it is. Not everybody's may be a little bit different, but 12 is a reasonable figure. What we're going to do is calculate a delta anion gap as well as a delta bicarbonate gap. And those two, in the case of acid-base balance, should be in some kind of balance. And now they're on opposite ends of a teeter-totter, and that's what this image shows. And that is typically as one goes up, the other goes down. So what we want to, but we will see a one-to-one relationship. That's what's important here. So let's consider a condition in which someone has a calculated anion gap of 10 and a calculated bicarbonate gap of 10. How did we get to those figures? Or of minus 10, rather. How did we get to those figures is where I'm going with this. One is that we use that 12 as the for the anion gap as kind of our standard. That's the normal healthy condition. So let's say that our person had an anion gap of 22 for whatever reason. Say they've got lactic acidosis or something like that with diabetes. And bicarbonate gap would be calculated in a similar manner in that we have a normal or considered to be normal bicarbonate of around 27. And by convention, that's the figure we use. So we would subtract the person's bicarbonate. And let's say in that case it's 17. So we have basically a one-to-one ratio. As the anion gap went up, the bicarbonate came down. And by looking at the delta, the change in these two, we see that they're really still in a one-to-one ratio. We subtract one from the other, and it gives us a zero. So there really isn't anything skewed. It is still explainable on the basis of this person has, say, diabetic ketoacidosis, and we're looking at a high lactate for that reason. And that's what gives us the pH abnormality and the anion gap and everything. So as long as it's in a one-to-one relationship. Now, we refer to this, that manipulation, often as the delta gap or something like that. And it goes also by the, I think, maybe delta bicarbonate. That can't be right. We've already got one of those. But anyway, I call it the delta gap. So this is, you want to see this in a one-to-one relationship. Here's an example. Let's just take a look at this and use it as in a sample and see what we come up with here. Here we have a 22-year-old guy. Now, obviously, these two pictures are not of the same person. The lower one with the baby is demonstrating something. But here we have a guy who's got nausea and vomiting, and he's in there roughing his socks. And so he's got a chloride that's down a little bit. His sodium maybe is up just a bit. His bicarbonate is clearly down. And we have a calculated anion gap about 35 here. And so the delta anion gap is going to be 23, 35 minus 12, using 12 as our reference. The delta bicarbonate, his bicarbonate's clearly down. And so that would be 27 as our standard. That's our considered to be normal situation. And his is 14, so he has a 13 here. So let's take a look and see. He has a bicarbonate gap. If we take a look at his delta gap, that is the difference between the two, would be about 10. Well, it should be in one-to-one if it's a single thing. He must have something else going on. Well, indeed he does. He has a high bicarbonate gap. And what is that telling us? Well, there's a metabolic acidosis, and there's something going on at the same time. He has a metabolic alkalosis. Where is he getting the metabolic acidosis? This doesn't seem to make any sense. Well, he's dehydrated. And because he's dehydrated, he doesn't have adequate tissue perfusion. He's not got hypoxia, tremendous anoxia or hypoxia out there in the tissues. But still, he has some poor tissue perfusion, so he's burning some sugars anaerobically, giving rise to some lactic acid. That's one thing. And he's dehydrated. And that's what this picture of the baby is showing, by the way. Where that little arrow is pointing is the so-called tenting. He has tenting of the skin. And that is to say he's dehydrated. You sort of pinch it and pucker it out. You don't put him in pain. But it stays that way as opposed to springing back. He's also got a metabolic alkalosis from the vomiting and the loss of the stomach acid. So these might be something you would think would counteract themselves, and in fact they might. He may have basically not an abnormal pH. And yet he's got these two conditions, one going one direction, one the other, and he very definitely has a combined acid-base imbalance. And how did we get to that? We looked at the delta AG and the anion gap and the delta bicarbonate gap. And it was not in one-to-one. It was a plus 10 here, so there was something else going on. Now, let's consider renal acidosis, situations in the case where the kidney itself is damaged. Remember the renal tubules, the proximal tubules are busy recovering our bicarbonate. And without that bicarbonate, we cannot really maintain acid-base balance. That's a recovery operation. But in addition to that, there is secretion of acid in the distal convoluted tubule. There are two ways in which we can do that. And failure of either of these will lead to what we call renal tubular acidosis. And these are characterized by a couple of things fairly consistently. Number one, there's not a huge anion gap as a rule. There's typically hyperchloremia because there's a net retention of hydrogen chloride. There are three basic patterns. Now, there are actually four of these types of renal acidosis. The number three, however, really isn't compatible with life. So there's a distal type, an proximal type, and a hyperaldosterone type, type 1, 2, and 4. Type 3, we never really see because that's a congenital absence of carbonic anhydrase, and without carbonic anhydrase, this fetus is not going to survive. Let's take a look at the specifics with these types of renal acidosis. We have impaired acidification in type 1, and this is, if you will look back at that, the type 1 is a distal type. That could be related to problems of the health of the cell itself, the distal convoluted tubular cell, a variety of things that could do that. The type 2 is the problem with recovering the cleared bicarbonate. It's in the proximal tubule cell. And in this case, the bicarbonate, as you can imagine, the plasma bicarbonate is down somewhat. The type 4 is related to low aldosterone levels, and again, that has to do then with being able to recover sodium and potassium and exchange that for hydrogen ion. Again, the type 3 condition is something that is incompatible with life. Where are we going to see renal tubular acidosis then? Well, typically we're going to see this as a consequence of poor tissue perfusion of the kidneys. We can see that with things that kill the epithelial cells, toxins and so forth, and that certainly does happen. I'd say more commonly, however, it's going to be impaired renal flow, vascular flow, like in the case of shock or something like that, potentially even leading to death of those tubular epithelial cells. Let's take a look at an example of this, and again, we'll calculate the delta gap, the delta between these two, the anion gap and the bicarbonate gap. Here we're taking a look at a case of a young woman, 24-year-old mother, who has perforated an ulcer. She has peritonitis, and she's gone into shock. And here are her labs. You can see her chloride is not as bad as a previous example we were looking at. Her bicarbonate, however, and her CO2 are quite a bit down. pH, she's very acidotic. She's obviously something is seriously wrong. This is a pH that's almost not compatible with life. It's at this level, we're going to have potential for cardiac arrhythmia and so forth. So let's do the calculations here. The anion gap comes out to 21. So the delta anion gap, that is using 12 as the reference, is 9. The bicarbonate gap is 23, again using 27 as our reference, subtracting her bicarbonate makes it 23. And so when we compare these two, the delta gap is negative 14. It says there are at least two things going on. Her anion gap is up, but it's not off the chart. Bicarbonate gap really is off. And it's saying what we have when we calculate the delta gap is that we've got more than one thing going on. Well, obviously we know if she's in shock, she has very poor tissue perfusion, and so there's very likely lactic acid being produced peripherally, but there's something in addition to that that's going on, and that is her kidneys. Because of the shock, we've had death of the tubular epithelial cells, and we have a problem with renal acidosis on that basis. And that also then contributes to the hyperchloremia, the inability to clear that. So she really has two related problems. One is the uremia, the kidney function itself, the tubular-related problem, and in all likelihood, a problem with hypoperfusion peripherally and lactic acidosis. How does this help you? This basically is telling you that you cannot explain her condition solely on the basis of, say, lactic acid, knowing that she's got poor tissue perfusion because, say, her blood pressure is down. There is a renal element here. Does that delta gap tell you specifically it's the renal element? No, it does not. It just says there's something else going on, and then you have to go and look for that. Okay, summing it up, we've talked about a variety of things that lead to acidosis and alkalotic conditions, some of which are a single cause. Compensation, obviously, we have to consider in this if we're looking at something that's gone on chronically. If we look at respiratory problems, typically we're looking at CO2-related changes. If it's metabolic, it's bicarbonate. And that, again, is in the case of a single cause. But not everything is a single cause. And so if we've got mixed arrangements, then we have to get around to that by looking at the anion gap and the bicarbonate gap itself and calculating that delta gap, as we call it. And these are not uncommon, again, in elderly people who may have multiple things or are on multiple medications, particularly things like carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, things of that sort. So you can even have a combined acidosis and an alkalosis in which the pH may frankly be in the normal range, and yet they're not. There's a metabolic condition or a respiratory condition that's pulling in one direction, something's pulling in the other. How do you learn about that? How do you know that's the case? You've got to look at the bicarbonate, you've got to calculate the anion gap and the bicarbonate gap, subtract those two, and say, hey, this is not in a one-to-one relationship. And the final frame here is basically a summation of what I was just talking about. And if you wanted to print that out, I suppose you could. It'd be something that sort of looks at a number of these conditions. But again, all of them have to be judged on the basis of the clinical findings, history, physical, and calculating that delta gap. And that's the story on that.